Welcome to Friend of Maryland. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Maryland, I speak briefly about HBO's new fear-mongering documentary, The Weight of the Nation. I chat with Jen Leyva about reproductive technologies in fat, with fat women, and I spotlight a piece from the Huffington Post by Dr. Linda Bacon about HBO's piece, Weight of the Nation. Late last week, HBO aired a four-part series called Weight of the Nation in the United States. This show is yet to air in other parts of the world, and I'm already getting lots of my friends and family asking me questions about the show and what I think. I haven't seen the show, but I have read quite a few other people's commentaries on it. And I have to admit, I'm a bit crushed and disheartened that a channel that I love so much, that being HBO, seems to have put together a series that does little more than reinforce the obesity epidemic hand-wringing and fear-mongering that we usually associate with any time the media talks about fatness. It doesn't seem like they've given much thought at all to issues of actual health or to talking to members of the fat activism movement. And that just breaks my heart. I'm hoping that this series will eventually air here or that I'll be able to watch it on iTunes, because while I know it'll cost me the sanity points, I'd like to see it for myself. If you're interested in checking out some of the great commentary that's already been written about it, though, check out Dr. Linda Bacon's great piece in the Huffington Post or Marilyn Wan's piece at FS Blogs. In news a little closer to home, the new study out of Monash University that finds that fat women are discriminated against within the workplace is getting more and more media attention. I'm going on Breakfast on TV One tomorrow morning to talk about weight discrimination in New Zealand, why it's a problem, and what we can do to change it. So check it out.
Today is Jen Leyva, a fat activist and student at Columbia University who writes Fat in the Ivy. Jen, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I'm really excited to have you on today to talk about your research because I think it's important, it's timely, and of course I can't think of anyone else who's doing it. So you look at reproductive technologies and its accessibility for fat women.
Yes. I was in a class last semester called The Politics of the Family in the Post-Genomic Era with Alondra Nelson. The long title means we kind of looked at reproductive medicine, especially it's concerned with like genetics and what that means in a social sense. I have a tendency of taking generic women and gender studies classes and sociology classes, and then turning them into fat classes.
That's awesome.
They don't offer any. There's no like introduction to fat studies by any means. It's me showing up and being like, well, how does this relate to fat people? And everyone kind of being confused and not knowing to like if they should tell me that I'm like really pretty because I just said fat or what. But generally after like week three, they're kind of on board. They're used to me. So I ended up looking at fat women being denied access to in vitro fertilization. It's actually like a really, not only timely, but like I think contentious and problematic issue. In the United States, to seek in vitro fertilization, there are no real governing bodies that have ultimate authority over who can and cannot access these technologies. I also looked at Canada and the UK because they have public medicine, public funded single payer healthcare plan. And what was a little bit interesting was that in Canada and the UK, they had specific weight limits, not weight limits, BMI limits, for who can access in vitro fertilization. I thought that was really interesting for a variety of levels. First of all, it's not completely. Although there are definitely aspects of eugenics involved, it's not completely eugenic because we're not denying fat partners access to IVF. For example, if there were a thin woman seeking IVF and a fat partner who wanted to be the sperm donor or the father of the child, like, that's totally okie-dokie. We're concerned about, like, the fat pregnant woman more than anything else. I also thought it was really interesting because as being someone in the United States, and as much as I think healthcare ought to be offered free for everyone, or at least, you know, heavily subsidized, plus or minus a couple co-pays here and there. In the United States, there's, as a fat woman seeking IVF, it's a lot easier to receive treatment. It might not be the first doctor you see, and it might take a little bit of work, and it's probably going to cost you a lot of money. But there are no real hard and fast rules about it, which I think is definitely better, because I don't think fat women should be denied in vitro fertilization. There have been some studies that quoted breast bank concerns over fat women not being able to conceive. A lot of this, I think, is tied to polycystic ovarian syndrome, in which case IVF is actually really effective. In certain cases, there's actually policies down where in order to receive IVF, fat women are counseled to have bariatric surgery first.
Wow.
Which I find, like, preposterous on a variety of reasons. Some of the arguments are economic in that, if IVF doesn't work, and if we can use then and then do IVF, it'll be more cost-effective. But probably some bariatric surgery is something like $10,000. IVF is something like $20,000. So based on my math, you get 3 trips at IVF before you've even gotten to bariatric surgery. not to mention that pregnant women who have had bariatric surgery and then get, like, women have had bariatric surgery and then get pregnant, there's a 3-year minimum waiting period after you have bariatric surgery before you're being pregnant, because being pregnant generally means you need to put on more weight, and that kind of doesn't make sense with bariatric surgery being that you're supposed to be losing weight. So that's also really funky, and especially with a lot of the women seeking in vitro fertilization, 3 years can mean a lot, like, more dangerous than risky pregnancy. If someone's 35, waiting until 38 can actually be a pretty big deal, both in terms of efficacy and safety.
So, wow. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm kind of, it's funny, I've even read some of your work, and yet I'm bowled over by just the relationships that, you know, you're trying to unpack between kind of the pathology of fat bodies and fat sexuality and fat health and all of those kinds of things. And of course the intersection issues. So obviously other things like sexual orientation and ethnicity and obviously class come into play, because if we're talking about you know, people who can afford to do those kinds of things versus people that can't. Wow.
Yeah, that's a huge deal. There's actually a medical sociologist, feminist, woman, gender studies scholar named Leslie Roberts, who's out of the University of Chicago, if I recall correctly. And she's been doing a lot of work about reproductive dystopias, in that currently, and as things keep going, especially in the United States, low-income people have terrible access to birth control. A lot of it's coercive. There's not much reproductive choice. And people who have access to money and, you know, have a lot of other privileges have so much reproductive freedom, have access to IVF, have access to all sorts of different, like, reproductive methods, and are able to really plan their family well.
Right.
And, what's really frightening is that these things are happening at the same time, and as certain segments of the population are allowed even more reproductive freedom and are allowed even more reproductive choice, other segments are more and more, like, coerced in lack of access to family planning access, and that's particularly frightening. And then you throw in a fat body in that mix, no matter what situation you're in,
yeah,
you're going to have a lot less choice place and reproductive freedom. And that's just, I think it's quite honestly like disgusting and unacceptable as a medicine, like a standard of practice in medicine, like modern biomedicine.
Yeah.
But I'm also one of these radical patties, so you know. Enough. Like,
you and me both. You and me both. So, I mean, where are you going to go from here? Like, are you going to continue this line of research, or will you now kind of move on to something different?
I'm, like, definitely interested in genetics and how we think of genetics with the fat body. I think it's similar to searching for a quote-unquote gene, and that we just want to explain the social behavior by, like, some quick and clear, down and dirty, easy, like, genetics, this gene, it's, you know, P3145, and, like, you either have it or you don't, and it's super easy, and we can understand it. But not only do I think we're not going to find that quick and easy, down and dirty gene to, like, you know, explain to that people, I think that even if we did, it wouldn't really matter. I think that there's a search for a fat gene because we want to explain the social behavior, and we're looking towards science to understand fat bodies because we don't believe the experiences of fat people living in those fat bodies to explain themselves.
Right.
So I think a lot of the genetics, both in terms of like reproductive genetics and also just day-to-day like regular genetics, are really interesting around fat. That's kind of my current project.
I guess I always thought that part of the search for a gene to explain, you know, whatever identity or behavior society, you know, didn't deem as appropriate or acceptable, whether that's the gay gene or the fat gene or whatnot, I guess I always thought part of it was that if you can find the gene, then you can quote-unquote fix the problem. You can, you know,
yeah,
turn that off or introduce a pill or, you know, something so that people wouldn't be gay anymore, people wouldn't be fat anymore.
That's also definitely a concern. I think that at least with, in terms of sexuality, there's, actually, I don't know. I think that's really, really frightening.
I agree.
very, very frightening. The good news is I don't think we're able to do that. I come from a science background. I'm majoring in biochemistry. So I know me from genetics. I know me from wet lab genetics. The good news is we're not good enough at genetics yet to do that. The bad news is we might be. And there is definitely some social pressure, especially with the anti-obesity campaign, but I'm using a lot of scare quotes there. That has emphasis on turning fat bodies into thin bodies.
Right.
I think what a lot of people don't get when they kind of approach turning a fat body into a thin body, aside from, like, I don't think it's rather effective, is that embodiment affects personality and character, and we cannot separate fat bodies from fat people. To eliminate fat bodies is to eliminate the fat experience and the fat identity. And that means more than just, like, buying big clothes or, like, I don't know, having, like, a larger surface area on your body. Like, it has some, like, very real social meaning.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of eugenics projects don't take into account embodiment and, like, what that means for our understanding of, like, ourselves and our being. I think that's true. Like, and this is a really high intersectionality point with disability studies. Because they're arguing a lot of the same points. For example, like to change someone who's deaf into someone who can hear is not just like changing. It's not just allowing someone to hear and like that's fantastic. There's a lot of culture involved. There's a lot of identity and like who you are and what it means to be someone living in this world and eugenics projects don't really think about that. And I think that is also particularly frightening.
Well, you've definitely given me and my listeners a whole lot to think about today.
there's a lot to think about there.
I'm trying to think of a way to like end this on a more positive kind of note. or something a bit more optimistic, and I'm just failing miserably.
I think the only like level of resistance that I've been able to find, aside from having like huge swaths of money to like allow yourself to access different medicines or different technologies, is to like assume your own health and not internalize the pathology of like that body as an internal pathology. It's not systemic. I don't think it's actually going to like create huge change if a bunch of fat people decide that like we're cool the way we are and we're not automatically diseased. But it's the only way that I can get through this research and like still have some sort of faith in anything is to like believe that they're wrong and believe that wholeheartedly.
Well, I like that. I think that's a good motto for us all to embrace.
I'm not diseased.
Yeah, I am not diseased. I am okay. And when in doubt, go get Hannah Blank's new revised copy of Big, Big Love to learn about fat sex.
I mean, when in doubt.
Or when you just need a good gift for someone you care about.
I might have a copy of it on the bookshelf right now.
Well, listen, Jen, thank you so much for coming back on the show and talking about your work, because I think that not only is your area of research and what you've been looking at really interesting, but I really love what you said at the beginning of the show about how you are a student who's at a university that doesn't have courses in fat studies, which is true for, I think, anyone who's not at San Diego State or at Macquarie University in Sydney. But like you said, you're taking the sociology and these women's studies classes where you're able to turn it to something that you're interested in. And I think that that's a really good lesson for a lot of us. So even if we find ourselves in situations that aren't obviously dedicated to or necessarily about fat studies or fat work, we can find a way to make it suit our needs.
Absolutely. Just like if you need to ask for a chair that doesn't have arms because your fat ass is too fat for that tiny chair, you can go into a classroom and demand that this class be pertinent and relevant and interesting. And I think most professors will respond to that. Like, if you've done a little bit of reading and you know what you're talking about and you're just really excited about whatever project you think would fit into a class, I think most professors are going to be responsive, even if they kind of don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, general excitement works well.
Well, thanks again so much for coming on the show, Jen, and I will look forward to having you back on again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Spotlight today is a piece published on the Huffington Post on May 14, 2012. The piece is written by Dr. Linda Bacon, and it is entitled Bread and Circus, Hold the Bread. Weight of the Nation Deserves an Imperial Thumbs Down. Quote, if HBO ran a miniseries called Health of the Nation, seriously, would anyone watch? An extensively researched documentary pointing out our many failures to wash our hands, floss, eat well, exercise more, and maybe watch less TV. How well do you think that would go over? But with the cable network's debut this week of Weight of the Nation, a multi-part documentary with accompanying book, websites, and government-hosted conference, America has settled in on the national couch. Like ancient Romans in the Colosseum, expect them to stick around to the end to see who survives and who gets torn apart. After all, on even the cheapest bleacher seat or rattiest futon, you're still a notch above the other, those hapless schmeals in the arena. In Rome, the stadium fodder tended to be slaves or Christians or baited animals. In Weight of the Nation, they're fat people. And not just fat, but given the nature of health economics in this country, likely to be poor and people of color too. I write in advance of the debut, but we've all seen enough obesity crisis coverage to know that The Lens won't capture many of the people who can shell out for HBO subscriptions unless they're the expert talking heads. I shudder to imagine how this will intensify the already rabid prejudice against fat people in this country. Of course, the producers claim to be all about concern for fat people and redressing the many harms obesity supposedly causes. But as author and attorney Michelle Simon writes elsewhere on the Huffington Post, the program's misguided attention to weight rather than health ensures the focus stays on the individual instead of the food industries, or other concerns I would add. What do you think when you see a fat person? That it's their fault, they just need to eat better and exercise more? There, I just spared a bunch of folks having to write that last bit themselves in the comments. And along with big food, there are plenty of targets Weight of the Nation could legitimately take on, like unequal access to healthcare, discrimination, and the extra stressors of poverty that might impair Americans' health. But, like the taxpayer-supported agencies that help fund it, the series simply reinforces the blame and the if-they-only-tried-harder stigma. Whatever remedies the show proposes won't work, so long as they aim to change the shape of 100 million or more Americans. How many diets do we have to try? How many miles do we have to log before we realize that these just don't result in sustained weight loss for the majority of people? Still, we plow on with talk of moderate diets, which don't work any better than extreme diets, and educating Americans that they're fat. Proponents may think they mean well by deploring the size and appearance of roughly half our nation, but it's easier to rail about fat than it is to examine the commercial and class motives that create the real health and wellness divide we live and die with. The real message of all the hand-wringing is not that obesity is a risk for health and the GDP. It's that fat is a cultural signifier. Just as swarthy skin and accents marked the lower classes 100 years ago, today we identify the other by waistlines and thigh bulges. And that's what you'll be seeing on HBO this week. To justify this exercise in prejudice, you'll hear a string of familiar-sounding solutions born from the same bias, myths, and false cause-effect constructs that already give us terrible obesity-based medicine and public policy. Many will rely on the self-serving pretension that there's a sort of fat brain myopia out there that keeps fat adults from knowing they're considered too big, with the false implication, of course, that education leads to downsizing. When it comes to children, the fat brain myopia premise assumes we can rail against obesity, but somehow shield kids from internalizing the deep disdain for fat and prevent inevitable increases in bullying and in body shame that follows for fat and thin kids alike. The first three of the HBO series 4 sections, as quoted here from the documentary's website, rely entirely on such self-justifying myths. Only in the final section does the documentary appear to begin examining the many non-weight-related issues that may affect the health of our society. Quote, consequences, examines the scope of the obesity epidemic and explores the serious health consequence of being overweight or obese, end quote. Actually, that so many are obese is a matter of semantics and a function of how we choose to define obesity, which has little to do with health. The real consequence of being overweight or any moderate obesity as defined on government BMI charts may just be that you live longer. This is according to the CDC, which in defiance of its own data is hosting this week's Weight of the Nation hand-wringing conference. Quote, Choices offers viewers the skinny on fat, revealing what science has shown about how to lose weight, maintain weight loss, and prevent weight gain. Quote, In fact, what science has shown on these questions is that most people, even when sticking to diets and exercise programs, that fact should surprise no one and is readily explained by biological mechanisms that assist sustained weight loss. The one well-established fact about attempts to reduce is that they will more likely result in weight gain than sustained loss. 7 prospective studies of dieting behavior indicate this. None show the opposite. Quote, Children in crisis documents the damage obesity is doing to our nation's children. Through individual stories, this film describes how the strong forces at work in our society are causing children to consume too many calories and expend too little energy, tackling subjects from school lunches to the decline of physical education, the demise of school recess, and the marketing of unhealthy food to children. Quote, If the latter are problems, why not train the lens on the food companies that profit from those school lunches? Why not divert the billions of public dollars wasted on fruitless and stigmatizing anti-obesity expenditures to more spending on phys eds, sidewalks, and playgrounds? Why not help kids of all sizes make good health choices? When the focus is on weight, it's not obesity that damages our children, but fear-mongering about their bodies that puts them at risk for eating disorders, discrimination, sedentariness, and lifelong discomfort in their body. The fourth section, quote, challenges, examines the major driving forces causing the obesity epidemic, including agriculture, economics, evolutionary biology, food marketing, racial and socioeconomic disparities, physical inactivity, American food culture, and the strong influence of the food and beverage industry, end quote. The problem with these influences is not that they make people fat. Thin people are subject to the ravages of biology in the food industry, too. It's their health impact. Fat may or may not hurt you, but fat stigma sure will, and Weight of the Nation bids to worsen it immeasurably. It's a wild, crowd-baying mob, frenzy disguised in a white lab coat. Don't watch it. The solution? If it's health we're concerned about, let's talk about health, not weight. From my book, Health at Every Size, the only way to solve the weight problem is to stop making weight a problem. The real enemy is weight stigma, for it is the stigmatization and fear of fat that causes the damages and deflects attention from true threats to our health and well-being. By focusing on health, we can address real health concerns, giving both fat and thin people the support they deserve, and avoid stigmatizing people and worsening the problem. End quote. Closing the show is Howlin' Wolf with Shake For Me.
Sure look good, but don't mean a thing to me.